Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 20 of the Circles Off podcast. I'm Johnny from BetStamp, and I'm joined today by Rob Pizzola. He finally let me do the intro, 20 episodes in. And today, we are also joined by a guest. He is a professional bettor. He is a partner in about 7 to 10 projects, which I'm sure we'll touch on a few of those today. And most topical, Unabated, the new, we'll call it sports data platform. We are joined by Rufus Peabody. How are you guys today?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm up in Maine.
I'm a little thrown off by Johnny doing the intro, if I'm being completely honest. Usually I have creative control of this podcast, and I had a joke lined up, ready to go, introducing Rufus and how he used to be Brian Blessing and Kenny White's, you know, basically guy, coffee boy intern type of thing, which I know Rufus would laugh at. But yeah, I'm doing well. I mean, just enjoying the summer, trying to golf. Rufus, have you been out golfing lately?
You know, I haven't. I didn't really golf much at all last month, which was kind of sad. But I played 9 holes this morning, and my brother's waiting for me to go golf after this podcast. We're going to go out and play as many holes as we can on this little 9-hole country club course here. So,
sounds good. Living the dream. We do want to get to a number of topics with you today, Rufus. Obviously, we want to talk about Unabated a little bit later. Also want to talk about some mental health initiatives. And I know that that's been something that's been important to you on Twitter for a while now. Usually with our guests, we get like a brief background and get them to discuss their stories and how they got into the betting space. I don't really think that we need to do that with you. Your story is pretty much well known. It's been talked about a lot, and I don't want it to get too redundant. So I'd rather just focus on where you are as a bettor now. And I think that would be a little bit more interesting for people who are listening. You're right around the same age as I am. Probably could retire now if you wanted to. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that that's the case. So I'm just wondering what still drives you to, you know, grind out the betting on a day-to-day basis. And is it even a grind for you at this point? I'm just a little bit of commentary on where you stand now on as a bettor.
It's a good question. And yes, I'm glad we're not going to talk about the LVSC years and anything like that. I think people on Twitter made it clear that they, you know, there's a lot I've said and they don't want me to say it again, but what drives me? And, you know, I love games and I love problem solving. And I think that's probably the biggest driver. You know, I look back, I was at Burning Man 2 years ago, and it was, I guess, my first real week off in a decade. And by the end of the week, I was just filled with ideas again about, like, you know, football. And I was like ready to get back at it. So, you know, my girlfriend said that she could really see from that like, I talked about being burned out, but she could see the joy I still had, you know, the passion I still had for it, that I'm doing something I enjoy. So, you know, I've always loved sports and the number side of sports. And it's, you know, you don't love every day of it, of course. And I've been looking for another challenge. And that's kind of, you know, why I've had these various other projects that I've entertained and Unabated is, you know, we're launching, we launched the beta yesterday to some people. And so I'm excited about that, but I am looking, I guess, looking for purpose in a way. A lot of the betting stuff is kind of running on autopilot. Well, golf for the most part. My traders would beg to differ, but you know, that doesn't take as much time for me now. But I mean, I think the big thing is I like games and it's still a game to me. And so I still enjoy it. And the idea of retirement to me just seems like this really foreign concept where, you know, you just sit around and don't do anything. Like, I'm the kind of person that I can't sit still. I need to be doing something. I need to be working towards something. And so whether that's something that makes money or not, you know, is immaterial. I need to have some sort of purpose.
Right. So just to elaborate on that, though, when you say you need to have some sort of purpose, it's usually building towards some sort of end goal, right? And for some people, that's monetary. For some people, it's being the best at their craft. For some, it's a combination of both or some other aspect altogether. I'm just interested in what that is for you.
That's a good question. I mean, I think for a long time, my purpose, like I guess initially when I moved out to Las Vegas, that sort of first hurdle to get to was, well, can I make money at this? And then I remember I would be like card counting, spreading like $5 to $35 at the beginning, betting a few hundred bucks at a time. And I was making money and tracking it. And I got to a point where I was like, you know what, if I lost my job, I could probably like grind out like 30,000 a year or something with the bankroll I have. And that was, that felt really good. And then, you know, betting, and then eventually got to a point where I was like, I want to be the best at this. Like, I want to be the best at what I do. And I think I've been kind of in the wilderness a little bit lately in terms of what that purpose is. I think it's a lot harder to, well, it's easier when you're getting started and sort of the goal is farther away. And like, I'm not going to say that I'm the best at anything, but I think I've done well at it. And it's harder if you're essentially trying to sort of stay in someplace than trying to go someplace. At least it's harder mentally for me. And I think that's honestly why now I'm looking for purpose in like building something, like building a company, building tools that I think could be useful, that type of thing. And honestly, that's why I'm talking about the mental health stuff on Twitter in a way too. I think this is stuff that I'm passionate about and I want to do what I'm passionate about.
Yeah. Got it. It's definitely, you know, would you say, so question then, would you say you're driven by money, or at any point were you driven by money? And then did that shift?
No, I moved out to LVSC. Kenny White paid me $25,000 a year salary. I think it was supposed to come out to $12 an hour, but I worked well more than 40 hour weeks. Although what was work for the company and what was work for myself is kind of a blurry line too. So, but no, I was never, it was never about money for me. Money was the scoreboard for betting. And so winning and losing, I mean, it was, if we had a big week in NASCAR, and I was never not the NASCAR modeler with this group back in the day, the good old days. When we had a big week with NASCAR, I didn't feel the same pride and satisfaction as if we, you know, won with my baseball model or my golf model. So money was just the scoreboard. I'm a competitive person, and yeah, it wasn't money.
I think that's an attribute that a lot of sports bettors share in general. The competitive nature, I guess some might call it an ego. And I certainly think that in terms of having an ego and a craft, I would probably say I'd have to put sports bettors right at the top of the list of any profession. I don't know if you'd agree or disagree with that, but I'm really trying to think of people that are close to me and people that I know. And it's a very competitive space, and where you tend to not see this happen in other industries where someone has success and it kind of rattles other people that are in the same space, rather than rooting for your peers to do well and fare well. It becomes more of like this dog eat dog type of situation. And I've always found that just really weird and fascinating.
There are a lot of frenemies, I think, right?
Yeah. It's like, you know, I think of an example where, we were together at Sloan a couple of years ago. And there was one night that Spanky took a group of 20 of us out to dinner, late at night. And Spanky sat next to Pikachu Bets that night, and they were chatting it up, and they're having a seemingly a great time that night and that week. And then a couple weeks later on Twitter, Pikachu Bets is just, you know, tearing Spanky a new one. And that's just one example that immediately comes to mind, but it's a lot of these situations where we interact in person. And I've brought this up with someone else on this podcast before. I can't remember who, but where we're interacting in person and seemingly getting along. And then we get to the social side of things or communicating elsewhere and people turn on each other. I don't know what it is about the toxicity of the space, but it just seems to, I can't really explain why it happens in the sports betting community so much.
I mean, I wonder what it's like with like hedge fund managers with their, I guess, their peers, if there's sort of this sense of like community and they're all, I don't know if they share ideas or if it's very much cutthroat and you know, dog eat dog. But personally, I think I was going to say a lot of it, I think, is the fact that you only, the anonymity and the fact that you only know people virtually. And it's so much easier to be an asshole to somebody on Twitter than it is in person. And people have asked me like, why am I not an ass to people that are, I don't know, that were touts or whatever on, when I meet them. And I'm like, well, I'm just not, I'm the funny thing is I tried to defend myself, but I'm just not really, I'm not a mean person, and it's really hard for me to, I don't like conflict and I don't want to create conflict. But personally for me, and people that I've met in person, I don't think I mean, I guess the whole Pikachu and Spanky thing, that's news to me, because I would expect that once you meet somebody that things would be a lot more civil, and that, you know, like I thought it'd be the anonymity that's kind of causing this, but maybe I think the Pikachu Spanky thing might be an exception in my opinion, but I really don't know. I don't know that many, I'm not intimately familiar with that many other industries.
Well, I think you brought up a good point with the kind of frenemy type thing. And I think it's driven by, you know, people want to be the best and they want to win at stuff. And the reality is, like, if you are driven and you're the person who's like encoded in their mind that they want to always be the best and they always want to win, they always want more, then you have to really, like, you know, look for happiness in other places, because you're not going to be fulfilled by making more money, because you're always going to be able to make more. It's like, I think Rob brought this up on the podcast, one of our first episodes. He said every time Bitcoin goes up, he's pissed because he doesn't own enough, even though, despite the fact that, like, you know what I mean? Like, your portfolio is literally growing. Like, if that goes down, you're going to be pissed, but it goes up and you're still upset. Like, this is just, it's almost like a metaphor. Like, if you have this mentality, you have to seek happiness in other places outside of just monetary gain, because you're always going to be able, there's always someone richer than you. There's always someone who does a little bit better than you or something else. Right. But yeah, it's funny, and I definitely don't think it's specific to sports betting, if that's what you guys are asking here. Like, this is a thing in every single industry. And it's kind of like, it's almost, I love ignorance is bliss is the saying, right? Where, you know, if you don't know, you don't know, and you'll be happy. But is it really bliss? Like, you know, because once you get into that mentality, you're like, the happiness is way harder to achieve.
No, I think you made some great points there. And I think it comes down to comparing yourself to others. And as I said earlier in my career, my purpose was trying to be the best, actually, for a long time. And if that's your purpose, then if anybody else is doing really well, you get kind of jealous. And I totally was guilty of that. You know, I'm friends with people and I don't want them to fail, but at the same time, I don't want them to succeed as much as me. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I definitely was guilty of, but I do think you see it. I don't think it's unique to sports, but I mean, just think about social media, like Instagram and stuff. People are always comparing themselves to others. And the funny thing is, the richer you get, the more poor you feel, in a way, because you're just comparing yourself to other people. Like, and it's the whole crypto thing. I mean, you hear about all these people that, you know, they bought their CryptoPunks and they've gone up a ton and they own all this Bitcoin, and you get like, you're like, well, shit, I'm jealous.
We got the CryptoPunks, Rufus. We're early adopters of the CryptoPunks right here. So we're been pretty excited.
Wow. Don't you wish you listened to episode 3, Rufus? Wow.
but if you view things that way, you're just going to set yourself up for unhappiness, because there's always going to be something that you're not going to be in on. And you just have to, I think it's just realizing that happiness, I mean, it's internal. It's you. It's not about how you relate to others. It's just about how, you know, it's an internal feeling.
Okay. We can get back to more of this and talk about your tweet threads and stuff, but now we are a sports betting podcast. I did put out a little feeler on Twitter earlier this morning saying, yeah, we're going to interview Rufus today. Any questions? There was a lot, some hate, some negativity, some positive stuff, but I think over the course of that thread and other people that I've talked to about you, like, a lot of people want to know, like, what's the life like of Rufus Peabody? Like, what are you doing on a daily basis? And sorry to ask multiple questions, but I do think earlier in the pod, you did mention, like, yeah, golf's on autopilot at this point and all the modeling and the hard work's done. So now it's just up to the traders. Can you give us a little bit of, you know, what goes into the golf stuff? How does it work? What am I doing? And then what are the traders doing? And, you know, give out as much info or as little info as you want. But I think that's really what people want to know and what you've kind of been hesitant to give out on other podcasts.
So I say golf's on autopilot, and yet it feels like so much of my time is still devoted to golf. So I guess it's on autopilot in the sense that I could only work on Monday on it if I wanted to. But I do spend a lot of time tinkering. You know, I'll give you an example this week. So I have a, Monday morning, I'm inputting my numbers I run a bunch of code that takes about 4 hours to run that basically processes the previous week. It basically refines the model, if you will, because you know, you're adding data every week. And so rather than doing it every year or something like that, it's just constantly every week. So somehow coefficients are changing. If somehow putting becomes more predictive, it's going to be changing gradually. And so I run that through and I put in, and there are some tweaks. I mean, I look at some stuff related to the course. On a hole by hole basis, I try to figure out what, you know, I need to obviously know the par and yardage of each hole. And I look at how it's played in the past. And sometimes I have to make a decision on if a course had a redesign or something, you know, and this hole's playing a little bit longer or, you know, where I sort of cut that off in terms of some of the hole by hole stuff. But basically I then spend time essentially making sure my projections are right. I mean, an example of some of the stuff I'm dealing with, like this week, you had the Olympics last week in Tokyo. And by the way, I was very anti Patrick Reed, because I don't know if you know, he was told on Saturday at the 3M Open that Bryson had tested positive for COVID and withdrawn. And so he was the alternate and he didn't have his passport. So he had to go back to Dallas, but to get there, he has to test positive or test negative for COVID 3 times, each 24 hours apart over a 72 hour period. And so he basically didn't end up getting to Japan until the day before the tournament and wasn't even able to get to the course. And same with his caddy, he wasn't even able to walk the course. And so I know the effect of travel in some other situations, for example, like, you know, and the fact that going from west to east is much more problematic than going east to west. So someone that played in America 1 week and is playing in Europe the next week, I mean, I don't think I'm giving away the farm by saying that you know, more travel and more jet lag is going to be worse. And this is a 13-hour trip. And then not having seen the course, like I was making a guess though on what that actual impact would be. You know, I had a framework based on what I knew the impact of sort of other travel is. And I was like, okay, well, you know, I think it's going to be at least twice as bad as that. And the funny thing is he actually ended up like playing decently, but he still, I think I still won the bets against him. I think I had Hovland against him and Casey against him. So that was good, but now they're coming back and I don't really have and personally, I think that it seems like if I get tired thinking about how tired the Olympians must be, you know, they're driving 90 minutes to this. They're going through all these tests and protocols all the time. And then, you know, you're turning around and even though you're going west to east, although they're traveling east to west, but they're going backwards in time. I feel like there's definitely going to be some impact there. And, but I'm making a sort of subjective judgment there. So those are the kinds of, that's an example of a kind of tweak I might make. Sometimes something regarding like, you know, home course or something, familiarity, depending on where a tournament is, things like that. And then I'm running these initial simulations and I have this sort of, server web interface called Verplank, named after my favorite golfer growing up. It allows my trader, my brother, who's my head trader, to sort of be able to run sims and you know, press a button to run tee time, update tee times, update weather, all that stuff. So basically after that, it's he can handle all this stuff like seeding different markets, you know, dealing with different betting partners and all that. But so the work on my side is basically just the projections. And if something goes wrong, that he can't figure out how to troubleshoot, then that's which by the way, that list is getting a lot shorter now, which is nice, but then that's when I am more involved. But this week, you know, we have something unique in that you have the Barracuda, which is a Stableford scoring system. It's the like 8 points for an albatross, 5 for an eagle, 2 for a birdie, you know, that type of thing. And so I had to rustle up some old code from previous years and I can't run this, like it's not automated on Verplank. It has to be, you know, I have to do it manually, basically. I have to find some code and do it. And then just, I send it to him and then he, you know, he deals with it. But that's the kind of thing that's, you know, and it seems like those things happen more often than they should. sometimes multi-course events, it's a thing. And so there is like, there is work. And then the other thing is that I get ideas sometimes. And so a lot of times I'm tweaking some things and I'm having to update some code. For example, I actually use the Datagolf stats feed now instead of PGA Tour because I was having an issue with PGA Tour at one point, or so I was like, yeah, I'm just going to use the Datagolf version, and because I can get everything from the same place. But then there's a week when for the British Open they didn't have their stats there, which is where I was getting the leaderboard, so I had to switch it back to the old one. So basically, you wanted me to talk more specifics, and now I'm making you regret that decision, I'm sure. there's a lot to do, and there's a lot of, I mean, tinkering and improving stuff. And golf is the thing, like, it's definitely the thing that I enjoy the most. And so that's why I spend time, like, it's the thing that is always the number one priority.
Yeah. I don't think we regret that question at all. I think a lot of people dating back to past discussions we've had on this podcast about an originator versus a market mover, things like that, a trader. So Rufus, by all accounts of the word, is just a straight originator in the sense, like, he's modeling the numbers from the ground up. He mentioned seeding exchanges, seeding different markets and things like that. But it's good to get that info, Rufus, about what goes on a week-to-week basis. Because like we've mentioned before, a lot of people think that, you know, originating is they make a model and they think, yep, this is, you know, I take my strokes gain, a course effects, things like that, and I whip it all together and here's my numbers. But what they don't realize is the additional work that still needs to go into that on a week-to-week basis or on a day-to-day basis for other sports, with things like lineup changes, things like, you know, injuries. And within golf, Rufus just mentioned a few of those things, like, you know, travel effects, different course changes, like when they make, you know, things like that, that are never going to be able to be 100% automated. So anyone who's listening and thinks that, you know, originating is a set it and forget it, even though Rufus is saying it's on autopilot, look at all the things he just mentioned he still needs to do on a weekly basis.
There's a couple things I wanted to unpack from there because I found that interesting. One being Scott Verplank being your favorite golfer, which is just, to me, like, there must be a gambling story behind that, right?
Well, you know, he's type 1 diabetes guy, right?
I actually didn't know that, but now I do. I mean, I remember Scott Verplank, but I didn't get a diagnosed with type 1 diabetes till I was in my mid-20s, which is extremely rare. So I don't know all, like, the athletes that have diabetes except for Max Domi. He's the hockey player that does.
What about Jay Cutler? Isn't he your hero?
No. I mean, Jay Cutler, if Jay I was
Cutler's
actually...
a legend. Don't you dare talk bad about Jay Cutler.
So I will say this.
I will stand by the fact that he was a better player than Eli Manning.
I don't think so, but, or it's, I
statistically speaking, they're like the same.
I think Jay Cutler has cost me more money than any other quarterback in the history of the NFL. And I'm fairly confident that that's true. Anyways, that's just a random tangent. But what I really wanted to talk about in specific there, Rufus, was something that hits home with me, because obviously I originate like you do. And when I first started modeling sports, I very much had the attitude of I'm going to trust this number. Like, this is the number I'm making on the game. I'm going to bet it. And I didn't start really working in, like, manual adjustments or subjective adjustments until 3 or 4 years into the process, where I started saying, well, I don't really know if I'm confident in this number or have enough information that I'm willing to bet this number at the edge threshold that I want to, or there's just, like, some circumstance that has come up where I want to avoid this game altogether. And that's what kind of eats away at my daily time nowadays, is, like, the models itself run, you know, pretty much automated, but then I kind of dig into numbers and I say, well, this doesn't make sense, this doesn't make sense. And I'm wondering if it's a similar experience for you, and if that's where you find yourself spending the majority of your time nowadays.
So I'd say no, actually. I mean, I think I've always been more of a trust the numbers guy. And for me to actually, it's the kind of thing that the bets that seem the worst, the ones that I question are often the ones that actually do the best, because there's, like, because the model I built is smarter than my intuition, I think. Mm-hmm. I believe that. I don't think my intuition is very good. So I need to have a objective, something I know objectively matters, and I need to have a framework for quantifying it. And if I don't have a framework, like if I know that, if I hear that some player was, you know, had food poisoning, and is still going to try to tee off the next day, yeah, like I'll avoid that. But I feel like that's kind of an extreme example. Like, I think, for example, the travel thing is something that I have a framework for being able to quantify in certain circumstances. And so I can sort of use that, something I've quantified, is a way to sort of quantify something that isn't really, that I don't have in my system. So, I mean, I'm mostly a stick with the numbers guy. And honestly, the stuff I'm spending or doing on a day-to-day basis, I would say is less like tweaks and is more, it's more just manual stuff and putting out fires, if you will.
Yeah.
But
Rufus, I mean, can you talk a little bit about, sorry, go ahead.
Wait, really quick. I'll say that I am much more open-minded now about adding in more qualitative stuff and making these tweaks than I used to be. Like, man, when I started out, I was like, I thought I was the shit. I thought I had like, I thought that, you know, I had somehow done what nobody else had done. Like, when I was LVSC, that like solved all this stuff. I mean, I think I think there was one guy at the office, I think Dan O'Brien, I think I really rubbed the wrong way, because I was just, I don't know. I was the less you know, the more you think you know, in a way. A little knowledge is really dangerous.
So yeah, I agree. One thing I was going to ask was, can you talk a little bit more about the trading side of things? So you said your brother manages, he's your head trader. Anything specific that you can give out, some stuff unique? I know we're going to talk a lot more about the trading side of things on next week's episode, but give us a little teaser, anything you can here.
Well, I mean, he's downstairs if you want his take on it, but I can yeah.
Bring him up. We're in for anything. This is a Circles Off. We do. It is what it is. We're presented by Betstamp. We don't have any other sponsors to please. You can bring him up.
You want to talk about the trading? Come on up here. You're about to be on the podcast. Okay, I'm bringing him up.
100%. Let's do it.
Thomas Peabody. I just assume Thomas is the full name.
This is Tom.
What's going on, guys?
Tom, welcome to Circles Off, our first ever dual guest podcast, episode 20. We were just talking with Rufus about the originating portion of the golf modeling. And he mentioned, you know, his brother Tom, head trader. We wanted to kind of like get a little bit into the process there. Give out anything you feel, you know, might not be too much. But yeah, it's a podcast full of sports bettors all interested to know kind of like what the day-to-day life of the trader is, and more specifically, Rufus Peabody's trader.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously it all starts with Rufus, and he mentioned he's sort of grinding on Mondays to get numbers out. And so work for me kind of starts Monday night in terms of betting outrights pretty much anywhere I can.
Wait, it starts before that. You're actually helpful. I mean, you're putting in tournament codes and you're essentially putting in a lot like field, like a lot of the course specific stuff.
Yeah. But I'm obviously not doing the originating. Just betting outrights Monday night. And then sort of Tuesday is a full day of, once matchups come out, rerunning stuff with tee times and just kind of trying to find value on matchups all over the place. So kind of grinding in terms of putting in a bunch of matchups from all over the place, and running them and just kind of seeing where we can get down. And it's really piecing a lot of things together more than anything. So
do you have a matchup set that's like, these are the projected matchups from that Chris is going to hang, or is it, you got to see it, scrape it down right away and then run the numbers?
I mean, we I'll put in like bet Chris matchups and then, you know, bet online matchups, and then I'm finding matchups on Circa and occasionally bunch of other places. And then just sort of adding those as I go and running those, but we've got, it can plug it right in and run it, pretty quickly.
We have some scrapers for books too, but some of them have like FanDuel like changed their stuff recently. So, and when he says grinding, I think like, you know, sending stuff to betting partners, et cetera. Is that
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Got it.
So sure. Rufus, you mentioned FanDuel there. I just wanted to, like, how has the process changed with the emergence of the regulated market, right? I know some people who have started to get down earlier in the weeks because of it, and now actually the majority of their action would be in regulated, although it's, you know, spread across hundreds and hundreds of different accounts in different states because of the limits. But just wondering if you've noticed a significant change, if it's affected how you guys get down on games, or whether it's just kind of been BAU ever since each of these individual states started regulating.
No, it's definitely, thank you, Tom. It's definitely changed things. It's created more work. We're getting down in more different places. It's, I guess, sort of networks of, and betting partners matter more. And that's never been my thing. Like back with, when I worked with Zach and Mark and those guys, it was, you know, they were always the ones dealing with the betting partners. Well, at the time we called them agents, but those were not like, and these were talking betting partners for, like, you know, the people that got accounts, like paperheads, different offshore stuff, not, not in like Vegas or anything like that. So now that I'm more solo, I don't have a huge network. I keep it fairly small. And part of that is, I keep things pretty close to the vest in that regard. You know, not, I don't really in the rest of my life, but it makes things, I prefer things simpler if possible.
Got it. Yeah. So it's a smaller team, but obviously a higher percentage.
Yeah, it still is. We Tom's the one having to deal with this with, you know, figures with everybody in every week and all that. I mean, I'll say we've expanded, like, I've expanded more into, you know, people in like Europe and stuff, which has been really, really nice to have because there's different markets there. For example, being able to bet each ways is nice. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is the people influencing the market there, the books there will often hang pretty different stuff. And so I do think there are opportunities, obviously, at the legal sports books in the US. And you know, I'm sure you've had lots of people talk about the challenges already of getting down without getting limited and all that stuff. And so,
So roughly, if you're willing to share, Rufus, roughly what percentage of your, getting down, I guess, would be from, you know, offshore versus the legal market or the regulated market?
Ooh. Well, the thing is, well, some of them, like, what about like regulated markets in Europe, for example? I mean, that's.
Got it. So let's say US regulated market right now, what percentage is that? Because that's what I think a lot of people think, it's much bigger than it is in terms of professional betting. When I think guys like us on this call might know that from a professional standpoint, it's pretty small.
Tom says very, very small.
And very, very
small. I was going to try to estimate a percentage. I was going to guess like 2-3%. I mean,
yeah,
it's probably a little more than that, but not a lot. It's going to vary because a lot of it is different bet types. Like I'm talking golf here. Golf is it. A lot of it's like the long shot stuff. I mean, I think it's also, I mean, betting golf, I think generally it's hard in betting outrights. It's harder for books to know whether you're sharp, I believe, just because, you know, there's not really like that much closing line value because they're not moving lines that much. And there's not a lot of signal in terms of whether you're winning or not. I mean, you can have an account that goes 3 months and is just basically losing every week. And you can still be a winning bettor because you're betting a bunch of 100-to-1s. And so, a lot of that though, I mean, but if you're betting these big long shots, you're not betting a ton of volume it's able to diversify me, which is nice. Like I like the fact that some of these have like the top country stuff and, I hope with the emergence of exchanges in the US, and I'm really excited for sport trade, and I'm hoping that I'll be able to do like essentially more market, do more on the market making side. Cause I mean, that's, I mean, in essence, I my number ends up very much shaping the market out there, and which by the way, has made things like DFS a huge challenge and something I'd basically just quit now. But it's, I want to be able to, if my number's being used that way, I'd rather be able to like directly benefit and be able to scale a little more if I could.
Do you think that exchange model is going to be successful? Do you think there's enough liquidity within the states themselves?
It's going to be hard within the states themselves. I mean, for a sport like like golf for sure.
Yeah.
But I do think long-term, I think once you have interstate betting that yes, it, I think it will be successful. And I don't think it means that it's a better model than the European model. I mean, I personally like it more, but I think it's different and there's room for, there are people that are not, that are being underserved by the current models and they will, you know, they will be, and you have a lot of these sort of market makers, a lot of, you know, Wall Street type companies that would love to get in this and market make. I mean, you see what, you know, just like over in Europe. And so I think it will be successful. And I know that's kind of a controversial opinion, but I just economically don't see how it won't unless the government, you know, won't let it.
So Rufus, like, are you legally allowed to, because I don't know the answer to these, are you allowed to seed, for example, a sport trade exchange in Jersey? How does that work? Is it like a guy like you allowed to do that?
I don't know. I think I would have to actually get some sort of license probably.
Got it. Yeah. Cause that's what the regulators are, they're trying to,
it's apparently, I mean, I don't think it's, well, I was going to say, I mean, yeah, I don't think it would be that hard to get a license necessarily. I mean, just given some of the books that are getting licenses, I don't have any, you know, mob connections or anything. So I think I should be fine.
So is it like a regular license as if you were to be a sports book, or are you trading under like a specific type? Like, cause again, I think the key to these exchanges succeeding, and everyone knows this, is going to be liquidity, right? You can't have an exchange. You had the founder of S Markets or S Markets on your podcast, Bet the Process. We'll give it a plug here at Bet the Process. Like, you can't have like a baseball game where there's only $100 to bet. It doesn't make sense. And like, when you have your exchange at that level, it's not going to work. But the key to this is you have to have people, you know, being enabled to see this exchange, right? If they're going to make it that you need like a full on license and you have to pay, you know, even if it's, let's say, like 50 grand a year, 100 grand a year, like the majority of people will never be able to overcome that payment and seeding an exchange. It doesn't make sense, right?
I mean, I think you have to get some sort of license, even if you take affiliate money, right? So if you're a website and you do an affiliate, I think you have to get, like, I think like Legal Sports Report and US Bets and all those, they have some sort of license because they're accepting, so I don't think it's one of these
intensive. So that license is just like a, I think Jersey's is free. It's like in other states, it's like, you know, a couple $100. And I think that's fine. But for the exchanges, I'm not sure if that's going to be even enough to suffice.
See, I don't think it's something that's sort of prohibitive, like if you were actually, you know, trying to start your own book. But I completely agree that liquidity is going to be what makes the exchange successful or unsuccessful. And I think that, you know, I know Sporttrade has a lot of, they have partnerships lined up with companies that want to, that are going to market make. I mean, there's a lot of people out there that there's, I mean, not individual, it's not going to come down to the individual people as much as it will come down to these companies. I mean, the Susquehannas of the world, right? Nelly Analytics and other finance companies.
So are they going to be able to like actively trade those basically as if it's a full portfolio?
Are they? Yeah, I think so. I mean, to me, what exchanges do is it democratizes bookmaking. Anybody can be a bookmaker. And you know what, whether, you know, it's whoever offers the best price, that'll get accepted. So I think it'll make the market more efficient if there isn't all this friction and barriers to entry, but it should, I mean, I don't know. I think it's fair.
No, I love it too.
We all agree on the upside to exchanges. I think we all know from a betting perspective how integral they can be in our day-to-day processes. It's just a matter of whether or not one can succeed in market. That's the question. And I hope that something does, because I think that will provide liquidity for all of us. And it, like you said, Rufus, it's just, you know, be able to get down on the best prices.
I believe it will. The question is how soon.
Right.
That's the question.
And I'm with you, because I hear Rufus talking about like, yeah, he's got his golf numbers, right? He's setting the whole market. So right now he's going through bookmakers, whether it be offshore, or, I mean, it is offshore, but it's going to be bookmakers offshore who are now taking a lion's share of those profits. And Rufus is obviously trying to get as much money down as possible at the prices that he thinks are plus EV and are going to make him money. So by having guys like Rufus be able to seed these exchange. And when I say seed an exchange, I mean frictionlessly. Like, he's got to be able to bang, put up everything right away. Then, yes, everything, like actively trade, like, you know, golfers injured, or like, you know, it's different in golf, but let's say NBA players injured, like rips off the board. You can't have, like, you know, sharks coming after you. If we can get to that point where the tech enables that, then I'll have so much more faith in an exchange being viable, because this is the proof for, like, anyone listening right now. Like, Rufus wants to get more money down at the correct price, at the correct pricing. So the exchange enables that, but the tech obviously has to be there. And that's kind of where I'll close it off. Like, that's my two cents. Like, if it's not there, then we're toast.
My problem right now, the correct pricing, the problem is that, like, I'll look at, like, round bets and I'll be like, there aren't any edges there, basically.
You know? Yeah.
No, yeah, and that's fine.
Find some more edges on
top
of that.
I mean, yeah, like, the correct pricing as in what Rufus can post up whatever he thinks is his correct price, and whether people are going to take that bet or not is fine. You know, you don't have to take every single bet that's offered, but as long as, you know, Rufus has a way to, like, legally say, yes, I want to bet more, here it is. I'm not going to get limited by this exchange. I'm not going to have to deal with, you know, getting cut off because I won X amount this week, or because I lost this week, but I ended up beating the close on all my matchups, right?
Right, right.
All right, Rufus. We'll shift from one product idea with exchanges to another, and let's talk a little bit about Unabated. I know that there's a lot of people in the space that seem to already know exactly what the product is before it even launched, and it's been in beta for a day. So I'll give you the opportunity to briefly tell people what Unabated is. I know that you're one of the co-founders alongside Captain Jack Andrews, who for my money is probably the best content guy in the entire sports betting space right now by a country mile, in my opinion. And Dan Fabrizio, who was the founder of Sports Insights, who I know from my trips to Boston for Sloan on a yearly basis, and who I think is a great guy as well. So I think you're hooked up with some great co-founders there. But for people who don't know what Unabated is, give a brief background on what the product is and what you hope to accomplish.
I thought you were going to introduce it, so I don't have to. I have to work on the elevator pitch, because I just end up going down a rabbit hole and getting caught in the weeds per usual. But it's a sports betting tools and information site, which that sounds, I don't know, vanilla. I don't know. I guess our tagline is your direct path to intelligent betting, but it's providing education. We have Captain Jack doing videos and articles on education. Captain Jack's doing a lot of stuff for it, but tools to essentially help you be a better better. I think I might have to pay Spanky for using that expression.
It's patented.
If we don't edit that out, we're going to get demonetized on YouTube.
So trading tools was the big thing that I think we kind of hinted at over the last, 6 months, I guess it is now at this point. Where's all the time gone? But that helps essentially people with bet execution stuff. If you want to bet this team, like, what's the best price available? Are you better taking this alternate line, this money line? Eventually we'll have stuff more in the derivative markets there. To me, that was more of that's something sort of low hanging, you know, that, you know, if you can save someone, a few tenths of a percent each bet, that adds up. And obviously, Rob, I know you have your half point charts, probably, you know, all, you know, you have, like, I, this is all stuff that I basically had built out in the past too. I mean, I have Google Sheet interfaces essentially for it, but sort of productionizing some of that stuff. But what we're going to have an odd screen as well. But what I'm most excited about, is allowing people, non-quantitative people, to be able to have a chance to quantify their own opinion. So we're launching this NFL simulator product, which allows you to take your own power ratings, NFL power ratings, or use one of our systems that are in there, or, you know, find another system that's out there if you want, or sort of combine them. And then it simulates the NFL season, and the results sort of integrate with futures markets. So you can see how your sim would price these regular season wins. You can exact number of wins as well, although we don't have a we don't have the odd screen for exact number of wins, but the odd screen integrates for regular season wins, division odds, conference, Super Bowl. And what I like about it is it's fully customizable. There's good data science behind it in terms of the rating change, the dynamic uncertainty, because what a team is now isn't what a team is going to be in week 7 or week 15 necessarily. So we allow in the simulation that team's rating to change as it has, or in a way that it reflects how ratings have changed historically. And so, but you can customize. I think one of the wrinkles we have in there, which I think is important, and it's something I never had in the Massey Peabody sim before, is quarterback injuries, because I think we can agree that quarterback injuries are a huge source of variance, especially for the elite teams with elite quarterbacks. Imagine like Seattle, Kansas City, Baltimore. If any of those quarterbacks got hurt, I guess we saw how what happened to the Chiefs' odds in game when Mahomes got hurt and Henny came in against the Browns. I mean, they valued Mahomes at like 7 points for one quarter over Henny, it seemed like. So basically different teams are more fragile. And so you can edit quarterback injury probabilities. And so we, on the back end, we simulate how long the duration of quarterback injuries based on historical injury lengths. And we've done some predictive stuff there. And so we allow the user to sort of customize the dynamic uncertainty, we call it the roof factor. It's the rating updating function, how aggressively or conservatively we update a team's rating in the simulation based on the simulated game results. So basically, if you're updating aggressively, it means that you are less certain about how good a team is going to be going into the season. So an example is the Jaguars. They have a rookie quarterback in Trevor Lawrence, highly touted. He could take the league by storm, or he could suffer. I guess what a lot of rookies do and start in struggle. So, and then you have Urban Meyer, a collegiate coach who is very successful. Will that translate to the NFL game? Maybe, maybe not. And so you could make an argument that there's a lot more uncertainty with Jacksonville than maybe another team like Atlanta or something. And so if you say, I want to make Jacksonville's rating update more aggressively, you'll get a wider range of outcomes, but the default is going to be basically what we found to be optimal for updating in the past and teams ratings in the past using Massey Peabody. And it's tuned to make sure it reflects what you actually see on the field in terms of the variance in season wins at the end of the season as well. So I'm really excited about it and just allowing people to be able to quantify their opinions and sort of tinker with what I think is a pretty cool tool and product. And
so tell people where they can find it right now. So you said the beta just launched?
Yeah. So you can go to unabated.com and put your name in the list to sign up to get early access for the beta. And we're going to be officially launching to the public close to the end of the month, I believe.
This is my full transparent review. I am friends with Rufus. I will say I did use the beta this week and I did quite enjoy it. I think it's a product that could potentially have mass market appeal in that I'm probably not your target customer now, Rufus. You would know that. And I don't think you would intend it to be. But myself 10 years ago when I was in university and was kind of putting together power ratings and didn't really understand how to model things, I could definitely see myself going down the rabbit hole. So I would encourage people to at least check it out, because I did spend some time navigating through the site yesterday, and I think it's worth checking out. So unabated.com, you can sign up for the beta, but I can't let you off the hook, Rufus, and you know that it needs to be asked.
I'm excited. Because I want to talk about it.
You know what's coming, because you've been critical of touts before in the past, whether that be on Twitter or on Bet the Process. In fact, last time I was on Bet the Process, you referred to BetStamp as quote unquote providing the needles for those that are seeking heroin.
Clean needles.
Which I didn't take.
Yeah, but in a good way, Rob.
Which I honestly, I didn't take offense to. And I gave you my rebuttal. And I think it's a fair opinion. as much as I don't agree with it. But now you are creating a product, or have created a product, in a space where you're most likely going to monetize via subscriptions, I would think. So I need to know, in your mind, what makes this different from what you would historically define as touting?
Okay, so I guess first off, I'll say that I don't have an ethical issue with touting per se. My issue is mostly with the ecosystem and just how many bad actors there are in it. And so, I mean, personally, I very much judge people on intent. And so I'm not going to be as critical of an outfit that sells picks and just doesn't like understand they're not providing value, and it, as I am of like a Vegas Dave or something. But I do think for the not bad actors, the issue with touting is that it's something that if you're successful, your customers end up cannibalizing themselves. You're moving the lines, and people can't get down at the release price. So I guess if you have this industry where if someone's good at it, the value of the product ends up suffering, I just think it's not really an industry worth steering people towards. So that's my general opinion on it. I think unabated, like I think betting is about, at least for me, is about asking the right questions and having the tools to answer them. And what we want to do with unabated is to give people the tools to answer their questions in a way. You can't literally just type in a question and get an answer. Sorry. But to quantify their opinion. And so I guess I don't want to build something where success makes the product less valuable for each user. Though I guess I will admit that that's something that the trading tools will do to some extent, though that isn't like our primary product. But I guess if you think about like the fun of a fantasy football league, if you're one of these people that's like really into fantasy football, you have all these tools, you do this research, you make projections. I want to create something that allows the type of person who gets really into that to get into sports betting the same kind of way. Like, I don't know if they're going to be a winning better, but I want them to have the chance to be, and the chance to really enjoy the process of trying to be a winning better with their own opinions, not being told what to do. And so I believe that, and for, I mean, maybe I'm wrong with this, but I believe that winning with your own opinion is so much better than someone else's. And I know money's all the same, but I'm targeting the people who bet on sports because of the challenge, the people that like the game of it. And, you know, I may be completely off base and there may be no market for this, but it's a risk. It's a gamble. And so did that answer your question there?
I think sort of. There's a couple things I could rebut, and I think they're probably worth rebutting in general. Because there's obviously the scenarios where there are touts who genuinely believe that they are winning touts and don't have bad intent. I'll throw out a name that people
know.
Ben the Better, I'm very confident he doesn't think he's going to win. But a guy like Spread Investor, I hate to give that guy a larger platform than he already has. But that's someone that I think anyone who is a seasoned sports bettor would willingly book this guy in an instant, like without even doubting it, based off of the write-ups that he writes for games and things of that nature. But this is a person who genuinely is selling picks and believes that they are a winning bettor. And under your original definition, this is something that I guess ethically you're okay with. Whereas for me, I'm struggling to see the logic there.
Well, I guess, I mean, in my life, I judge people on intent. If someone hurts me and they didn't mean to, I'm not going to hold a grudge, versus if they did mean to, I will. And I guess in a way, the issue that I was saying with BetStamp, or my issue with I guess supporting pick selling is that you give someone like that, someone, I mean, I don't know him, but, or her, I don't know, but who doesn't necessarily know that they're not providing value, the chance to sell something that doesn't provide value, right? Which they're doing it in sort of an innocent way. They're not, their intent is not malicious. And so, you know, that, I guess that is why I want to, I don't know.
So I'll follow it up. I get it. I'll follow it up, Rufus. And then I got a couple questions as well that some people sent in. But so, yes, you've obviously been critical of touts in the past. One thing that I guess people want to know the answer to, and I don't mean to be like negative when I ask this or anything, but like, so do you believe that people who use unabated will be able to win? Because it's kind of, and again, it's it's a sticky situation, but you just mentioned like in terms of people selling something that is not providing value. And even if they believe it or not, it's kind of like a gray area. So when you're looking at this product, like what's the market? Are people going to win when they do it? And then further to that, you mentioned if there is good touts, such as, you know, you've mentioned, you've quoted Right Angle Sports in the past, and this is something that he asked on Twitter today as well. You know, Ed has said like he gives out stuff that has market influence and moves the market. And the critical response to that is, well, then all your customers are cannibalizing each other. So with Unabated, personally, I do feel it will have some value at the start, but isn't there kind of a that same trajectory where that data will get eaten into and eventually, you know, sportsbook A catches wind and this closing line value and the inefficiencies in that drop down menu go somewhere else? Like how do you see that all playing out? And like, do you think there's going to be sustained value in the product? I'd love to hear it.
Well, okay. So I don't remember what the first question was, so I'm gonna go with the second one first.
Okay. Go ahead.
But I think you're right with the trading tools and the drop down. Like if those are good, if the market finds them good, then yes.
And sorry to cut you off, but I do think they're going to be good for listeners. Like that Pinnacle drop down, I don't believe is sufficient. So Rufus putting that out, I think is good and will have value in the start. But like you said, then where does that go? So go ahead. Sorry to cut you off.
Hopefully we don't have any bugs in it or anything. I honestly, I'm scared about that. I'm scared that people are going to find something wrong with it or something. I'm going to look dumb.
Well, we deal with that with the bet stamp conversions as well, right? Because we're giving the best price available and we have to do the conversions on our end. So we sweat with that for a long time. And I can imagine you're in the same position now. It's an uneasy feeling.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like that's the kind of thing where anybody, like people can sort of see if there's something wrong. Whereas like if there's something wrong behind the hood with the simulator, it's going to be harder for them to see. But I think if we talk about like the simulator product, which is, I think, more sort of what I see the DNA of the company being, it's something that there isn't one answer. So, the first question was, will people win from it? Some will as a result of it and some won't. I mean, if you give people tools to find the answer, whether they win or not is based on the question they ask, right? I don't think that metaphor really made sense, but the point is that we're going to allow people that otherwise wouldn't be able to sort of do certain things because they don't have the technical skills or necessarily want to learn them to be able to quantify their opinions and to sort of go deep and explore. And so I think it's going to make some people winning bettors and it's not going to help others. I think the fantasy sports is a good example because there's so many resources out there for fantasy sports. And you could say, well, is this making this person a winning fantasy better or better fantasy player? Mm-hmm. And, you know, in some cases, yes, in some cases, no. But my goal with this is to kind of give the user agency. Like if their opinions are good and they don't have modeling experience, but they have good opinions, then we can help. Like I want to be able to help them shape those into a number and be able to win sports betting with that.
Right. And
I think there's going to be a lot on the education side that will help people become a winning bettor as well. But I don't want to give you the simple answer of yes, signing up for Unabated is going to make you a winning bettor.
I think that's a fair answer, what you've given. And this is my personal opinion, obviously, but I think we've kind of gone off the deep end here a little bit. And I think this is largely to do with your opinion and your stance on touts in the past. And this is why you're getting this sort of negative feedback just in general. Because like you have a service like Don Best, right? Which people pay $500 a month for. That's not necessarily going to make you a winning bettor, being able to see an odds screen in real time, but it's a service. It's something that people, they want in order to, you know, try to improve their experience. And it's the same with any sort of betting tools, right? Like with your NFL simulator, it's only going to be as good as the inputs that go into it. That's just the reality of things. And in some cases, the inputs will be good. In some cases, the inputs are not good enough to turn that person to winning better. But regardless, it is a service that that someone is paying for because they want, and they feel that that can enhance their experience in some way or another. And I do feel you've gotten a lot of criticism just in general because of your opinion on totes. And had you not been so vocal and upfront about that in the past, Rufus, I don't necessarily know that we would be here right now with the criticism of a product before anyone even sees it.
That's true. Although I will say, I think the constant criticism of it has probably been a net positive for it.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Everybody on, like, Ed keeps talking about it, everybody keeps talking about it. We're, you know, for 6 months and we didn't even have a product yet and didn't even know what it was going to be exactly. And now, yeah, I mean, we had a ton of people sign up for early access. I was surprised at how many. And so, but yes, I get that. I get that my stance on touts, brought that on, and I still believe what I believe about touting. I think it's an ecosystem that overall is a huge net negative. And so, and I'm not going to run away from that opinion. And I think there's clearly people that are good touts and provide value. I mean, someone like Ed, right, provides value. I've never personally been a subscriber, but clearly people are able to get down at the release line. I assume otherwise, I mean, nobody's ever said that they have, as far as I know, said they haven't. So, you know, there are good touts, but I think overall the ecosystem is a negative, you know, it's a huge negative. And so my criticisms have been largely the ecosystem, and yes, I think I've probably been a little too black and white, but I think overall, if you sort of that nuance allows people to, I mean, people, if you tell people that 2% of touts are providing value, they'll think that they'll be more likely to find that 2% in like 25% of touts, if that makes any sense. Sorry, I was not very eloquent at all there, but
yeah, I think I got what you're saying. It makes sense to me. I mean, it's obviously, my viewpoints are different on a lot of these things, having been a tout at one point in my life, which your co-host does give me, your Bet the Process co-host gives me a lot of slack for, just in general. But I think another fair question that comes up in general is in regards to, you know, if you're putting a product out there that's going to help bettors, are you not, in a sense, reducing your edge? Like, if you have tools on site where you can compare two lines to find a better price or compare alternate lines and things of that nature, is that not taking away some of your expected value? And I think that's like anyone, I don't want to say anyone that's critical, but some people that have been critical have been pointing that out or asking that question. And I'm curious to what your take is on that, Rufus.
No, that's a very fair criticism. And I think they're correct on that. I think that one, that will. I thought that was kind of an easy win for us. And it's something that, you know, I think I would never have put something out like this 12 years ago because there was so much value betting derivatives. And, you know, now it's pretty simple. I mean, there aren't these huge egregious inefficiencies in derivative markets the same way there used to be. I guess I thought it would be, I thought having that and allowing people to essentially execute their bets a little bit better. I think it was meant it was built with the user who's trying to figure out which price should I take, -6.5, you know, -110, or, you know, -7 +100. It was built with that user in mind rather than someone who's saying, oh, like, how can I like build a bot to like scrape all this stuff and then just automatically execute these bets and all that. And so, but yes, I get the criticism. I think it will make, hopefully, if it's a good product, it will reduce edges. So yeah, I think it's a valid criticism.
In all seriousness, you know, we give Rufus a hard time, but everybody go check it out. So it's unabated.com. You can sign up for early access. I know I was playing around with it today as well. Notice a lot of great tools outside of the ones we mentioned. There's a really good CLV calculator that goes even a little more in depth than what we have at BetStamp and could be a good complement. You've got also things such as, like Rufus was mentioning, you know, the ability to, you know, take a look. Should I bet the 7 or am I going 7.5 here? And what's the comparison in between those two? And, you know, regardless of if the market's going to adjust or not, I think tools like that will always have value just because of the price discrepancies between books. So everybody go check it out. We're critical here, but, you know, product hasn't even launched. We're excited to give it a try. And we did have one more question though that came in through Twitter from a burner account. We're going to give this guy something here. Rufus Peabody, how much are you down betting, and is it the main driving motivator for going tote? we had to read this.
I love
one,
that so question. I was like, I've been trying to be all positive and stuff. I was like, I don't even know what to say to that question.
No, we're just joking.
How much are you down?
What are you down?
Last week, actually. I had a very good week last week, but I could have told you the 2 weeks before that weren't that good. So,
no, that's good. Anything else before we want to get to our closing question, Rob, Rufus? Go ahead.
First, I want to say that, and you said you guys give me a hard time, and I know I gave Rob a hard time, but I think that stands a really cool product, and I'm a fan. So
listen, you know, we talked about the
tout service part as much, but the CLV stuff, the odd screen, I think it's cool.
There is a weird toxicity in this space. I don't know what it is. I can't describe it. But there is, there's just something that, I don't know, like I said, we talked about it an hour ago off the top, and I can't really explain it. But yeah, like, you know, Rufus is first launching a product, and the completely transparent, my first thoughts are like, what the hell, like, is Rufus think? Like, what could this possibly be? His stance on totes, and now he's going to go do this. And then, you know, I've used the product after a day. I'm like, oh, this is pretty cool. I actually tried to upload my power rankings from last year using the template that was provided, and I was very interested in it. So I've already
the template wasn't working yet. So
it will
be tomorrow. I'll tell you that.
It's a beta form. Yeah. Well, maybe it has something to do with that Rufus had in his Twitter bio for the longest time, that, you know, that old quote, not trying to sell you anything. And then as soon as he launched unabated, Ed called him out, and it went, I guess we'll call it viral for gambling Twitter standards. But that's another funny one. Like, got caught. It's like a college player who just got drafted and forgot to delete his old tweets from high school.
No, that was funny. Ed bringing that up. I had to change it to not trying to sell you anything yet.
There you go. Yeah. You have to get out of it. Okay. So anything else before we get into the close then?
Let's wrap it up.
Stuff on the outline that we didn't even get to.
Okay. You know, if you're good to Rufus, stick around, we can stick around a little longer.
We will have a part two eventually. I know you have a Twilight Golf round. I understand that, and your brother's probably waiting on it. We do have the intent of having guests back on in the future. We're in like a sweet spot in terms of the time of the podcast. I know some people are like, oh, you can go for 3 or 4 hours and I'd listen to it, but not everyone will. So we're in that sweet spot right now. So we will wrap it.
We got to have Jeff Ma on before we have Rufus again. Otherwise, we're going to be really in the doghouse.
Well, Jeff already is going to probably message me on the side and say like I'm dead to him or something for inviting Rufus before him. And then also, like, he always calls you Rufus Peabody. You notice that, Rufus? And is like that how you pronounce your last name? And I've been saying no. Peabody a longer. Okay. I don't know. Is he just pissed?
It's the Boston thing.
Okay.
It's, you know, it's like there's Peabody, Massachusetts, and Jeff went to Exeter, or maybe it was Andover. He's going to kill me for not remembering which one. But were we going to get into any of that mental health stuff or no?
Let's do it. Let's just do it because it is important. And it's recently come up, and you tweeted this week about a thread about self-acceptance just in general. And I mean, part of it, let's kind of like backtrack, Rufus, because I think a lot of this stems from social media in general and a lot of the negative commentary that you've gotten in the social space. But a lot of bettors just in general tend to, you know, not gravitate towards social media. They like to remain anonymous. On a personal end of mine, I started social media because I was trying to build a brand for myself in sports media, but if I could go back and redo things, I wouldn't have a Twitter account or anything like that because of all the negative experiences I've had altogether. And I'm just curious what drew you to social media in general after being a bettor that, you know, largely remained anonymous for a long time. And then kind of how did things devolve for you into the situation over the course of the last couple of weeks that's led you to open up a little bit more about the mental health side of things?
So first off, like Zach Gambleballs on Twitter will tell you that, you know, I've always like, I mean, for him, it was betting was about money. And for me, I've always, he's like, Rufus has always wanted recognition. So he'll tell you that. And I think that's true to some extent. But I think I've always been someone who's very public and open about things. That's like who I am in real life. And I probably revealed more to strangers than most people. And I share a lot with friends, though that's mostly like dating related drama. But I think it's part of my personality. I'm excitable. I'm a talker. I like sharing things and I like connecting with people. And so I think the problem is when you treat social media like a game, like how can you get the most followers, most likes, that kind of thing. But I guess the quality I really value probably the most of all in life is authenticity. And it's and honestly, it's probably why guys like Vegas Dave bother me so much, because they're phonies and I try to be myself. And so I think that yes, I liked getting recognition because I don't know. I mean, who doesn't, right? I mean, I think I was at a point, I guess, when I joined Twitter, I just followed a bunch of golf accounts and I wasn't using it at all to, like, you know, post stuff myself, but it was, I guess it was after what, I mean, I guess I gradually grew, but it can become a drug for sure. You're looking at how many likes and, you know, how even like my dad has an Instagram account and he was, you know, he talks about how, I mean, he's this amazing photographer. Well, he's an amazing architect, but photography is his passion. And you know, he posts these really cool old pictures but he said like, oh yeah, he looks to see how many people liked it the next morning. I mean, it is like social media is a drug. And so we have to, it's really hard to use it responsibly. And I think I mean, when you're constantly being bombarded with other people's opinions of you, it's really hard not to sort of internalize it. And so I guess, did you ask, why am I talking about this now in the last few weeks?
Yeah, like sort of what led to this? I mean, it sort of seems like an introspective you sort of done on yourself and just kind of bringing it to public light. I mean, it's not like you haven't voiced your feelings openly before on Twitter in the past or through Bet the Process as another platform for you to do so. But it seems you've really been on this kind of bandwagon over the last couple weeks of just really being open and upfront about how you're feeling and kind of trying to turn things into more of a positive. So kind of what's led to this?
Yeah. And Rufus, we noticed we switched your bio on Twitter as well, to the Buddhist philosophy optimist by nature.
Yeah. I mean, I discovered Buddhism in late 2015, this Buddhist center in DC. I had been, you know, I'd had lunch with a friend who was for my birthday, and she was like, Rue, what are you doing for you? Like, you look so stressed. You're going to like die by age 45. Like, what are you you need to be, you know, are you meditating? Are you doing yoga? So I'm walking home and I like, you know, I'm open to the universe and I see some sign for free Buddhist classes. And so I go, and it wasn't, or not Buddhist class, sorry, free meditation class. So I go and it wasn't that great. It was some pre-recorded thing. But I meet someone there who's like, you should come with me to this Buddhist center. And you know, later we ended up dating for a little while. But I end up really loving it. It just, to me, the Buddhism thing, just, it makes so much sense as a better. I mean, we are dealing with making decisions under uncertainty and then losing control. You know, you bet something. Although I guess now you can live bet the entire game, but you bet some, but not for golf, but you bet something and then it's out of your hands. You make a decision based on the information you have, and then you have no control, and you have to be able to let go and not stress over it. And to me, it made so much sense. I was like it just, something clicked. And so I think that was the sort of start of my journey right there. And right now I'm in a sort of a period of transition in my life. And so I think, I've had some adversity, and I think those are times when you really reflect. And honestly, like, I think I've grown more in the last month than I have at any other time in my life. And I'm in the best mental place I've been in my life. And so, it's a work in progress still. And I'm going to look 10 years from now and I'll be like, wow, look how far I've come. I'm constantly growing, but now I forget what the question was. This is what happens with someone like ADD, like me. I just start talking and don't stop.
Well, honestly, it's great to hear that just in general. I mean, I've been very open about kind of my journey as a sports bettor over the years, and there are certainly plenty of ups and downs. And I think with each down period that you have, kind of the goal I have on a personal level is just to try to get out of it a little bit quicker and try to develop some new hobbies or some other techniques that kind of help me get out of that. And I know you've talked about seeing a therapist, Rufus, and that's something that I've done in the past as well. And now sometimes I'll just spend half an hour like in darkness listening to music with my headphones on or exercising a lot more. And I think there's different things that work for different people. But I'm glad you found something that's worked for you and you kind of regain that positivity, because I know what it's like to be in that situation where you know, you just feel really overwhelmed with a lot of things that are going on and it feels like there's no end in sight. And maybe in a lot of cases, I think you're like me in that it feels like maybe you've taken on more than you can chew at times. So I'm just glad that, yeah. And I mean, I don't really learn from that mistake, and I've done that several times, but I mean, it's a journey and it's a process, and it's not unlike what we do with our day jobs of sports betting and just looking for continuous improvement. And I'm glad that you've taken the time to spend on yourself and improving who you are as a person and getting to that positive state again. So I'm really glad to hear that on a personal level.
Thanks, Rob. I'll say the biggest thing I think that's made me happier in terms of how I'm dealing with social media is just not getting defensive. That was always my initial reaction if someone said something negative, like the guy that said, how much did you lose, right? I would be like, I didn't lose. Well, actually, that's not a good example because there really isn't any, I mean, there's no validity to that. But I guess just essentially being like, you know, if a criticism is valid, just being like, okay, it is. You know, if you admit that, then it doesn't have any power to hurt you. I think, and it's like this incredible, it's like having a body armor in a way. I can't really describe it. It's given me this like just more, this peaceful feeling where I can engage and I can be myself. And I'm naturally a very positive person. Like I have energy, I'm positive. And that's, yeah. And I feel bad, but I just want to say, mea culpa here. Like, you know, I've definitely been negative on Twitter at times, many times. And so I'm going to try, just like Rob, remember when you were positive, Rob?
That lasted like maybe a couple weeks. I tried. But yeah, I remember those days. I do.
That was like last year, wasn't it?
It was like a year or two.
He's tried it four times. That's not
clear. But you are still less, I mean, like your social media's evolved too. I mean, you used to be all like, what, you had like 100,000 tweets or something crazy like that, right? You're one of those people that Spanky said must be a huge loser because he has that. Anybody with 100,000 tweets has no life.
I mean, the advice that I it's not really advice, but I just reached a point where I stopped caring about what other people have to say. And that's not to like say that their opinions don't matter. That's not what I'm getting at. It's just that I guess it's very similar to you, Rufus, in that, you know, I just kind of have found a way to ignore the negative commentary. And certainly there are still things that people will tweet that kind of trigger me. And I'll just, I just take a step back and kind of collect myself and just move on with life, right? Like life is too short. To spend time focusing on things that really shouldn't affect you on any level.
But would you say, so I would still say though, that overall, my experience with Twitter and all that has made me stronger than if I hadn't had that. Like, I think I'm a better person now. It's allowed me to go on this journey and to become like this person that accepts himself a lot more.
I would say I would agree with that. And just to further that a little bit more, like I owe almost everything that I have to Twitter. Like, I've made so many connections in this space and made new friends that I never would have interacted with, who live all over the world. Like, I had a guy visit me from Italy that has like an obsession with me a year ago, and I will go visit him in Italy, and he has a lifelong friend with me. And I deal with Fabian Sommer, who's, you know, he's in Germany. I've had movers in the Netherlands, and this has all come about because of Twitter as a platform. So, you know, it's easy to say it, you know, in hindsight, I've had a lot of toxic experiences, but I don't know, social media has elevated my life in a lot of ways as well. And I'm naturally not a pessimist. I know you're naturally an optimist, so it's harder for me to focus on those types of things. But I think when I do reflect on that, it's something that comes to the forefront for me, in that I've had way more positive experiences with Twitter than I have negative.
That's awesome.
Rufus, would you, if you could redo it, would you join Twitter under your given name, legal name, or would you do it under an alias?
I don't think any alias would be more believable than Rufus Peabody, right?
Okay. He's hinting that it still is an alias.
I would, right. I know, it's true. They don't even know my middle name is Learned. But yeah, I would do it the same. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I think it's me.
Well, it seems like some of these opportunities, you know, they wouldn't come up if you weren't, you know, hadn't built a brand under your own name. And same thing with Rob as well. Like, I took the opposite approach. Like, I never really cared to have my own social media under my own name, basically based on all the toxicity. And also just, I don't like posting very much. I like reading, but I hate posting anything else of my own. But yeah, like, doing it under your own name, it takes, like, you know, it takes balls to start that up, because like you guys mentioned, like, there's so much negativity. You are two of the most notable in the gambling Twitter space that actually entered under their own name without, you know, from the beginning.
Well, there was never a grand plan, I'll say that, you know.
Before we get into our closing question, Rufus, I just want to set the record straight on something that I don't think we've ever discussed, even off air before. But Jeff, your co-host, Jeff Ma, likes to use the Rufus is a dog's name line. He stole that from me. I need to clear the air, because I was the first to say Rufus is a dog's name, and it caught on with him. But I also stole it from someone else who used to be on Twitter at Thrill Barton. I don't know if you know the story of this guy.
Johnny, you gotta tell it. You gotta tell it.
Is it David Bote? Is that who?
It is David Bote.
Okay. So this
the assassin.
On August 12th of 2018, we're approaching the 3-year memorial of this guy. He basically tweeted, "If David Bote ding dongs here, I will never tweet again for the rest of my life." And David Bote hit a home run on that at bat.
I think it was bottom. It was bottom 9. He hit a grand slam to win him what we assume was his bet in that game.
Right. And the guy hasn't tweeted ever, but this guy was he coined the phrase Rufus is a dog's name. So I feel like, I'm going to give him the credit that he deserves while we have you on here, and take that credit away from Jeff, who seemingly loves to use that.
Hey, I'm fine with bringing Jeff down a peg if you want. No.
So Jeff's
a great guy, in all honesty, but. And I interrupt. I just want to also set the record straight. And I interrupt Jeff just as much as he interrupts me. Maybe more. I don't know why people go after me for the interrupting.
I will say that leading up to this interview, we spoke off air for about 15 minutes before we started. We started this pod today, and I was getting very infuriated with the amount of interruptions that were happening. And I was thinking in my head, I'm like, I hope this podcast does not turn into this. And it didn't, luckily. But it was just us talking over each other for a long time. I was getting mad.
Well, Rob, that's like, I struggle with interrupting. Always have. Hopefully won't always, but it's, yeah, I get excited and want to say stuff. I need to be a better listener.
We all have issues though on podcasts. It's a tough forum. Like we're not in the same room right now. So it's like, it's always tough. Like I realize I have this issue where I ask a question, but then I don't stop. I ask like a minimum 2.7 average questions per question. And then the guest like, all right, I'll get to all those, but it's going to be like a long-winded answer. So, you know, we all do stuff on podcasts that it doesn't happen in person, but it's just a different forum. So, you know, don't worry about the interrupting. It is what it is.
Oh, no, I'm saying it happens in person for me.
Oh, okay. Then you got to worry about that, buddy.
But if you actually have you been diagnosed with ADHD, Rufus? Okay. So like you sort of have an excuse, right? Like it's a medical condition that would cause you to do that.
It's also a superpower. I really believe it, and I wouldn't trade it for the world. It allows me it to be creative, to be excitable, to be positive. I don't know. I think it a lot of my best personality traits, I think, come from it. So,
well, your Twitter bio reads optimist by nature, and I've never heard anyone talk about ADHD as a blessing before. So I think you truly are an optimist by nature, Rufus.
You haven't talked to enough people with ADHD then.
Oh, I'm surrounded by them. All my close friends growing up.
I literally think almost all sports, it seems like every sport's better. If I, when I say that to someone, they're like, oh yeah, me too, actually, you know.
All right, we're going to wrap it up here. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Rufus. We do have a closing question that we always ask.
Wait, can I wrap this up with two questions in true fashion of myself here? Somebody asked on Twitter, because it leads right in. Okay. So someone asked on Twitter, you know, to give out your biggest non-betting plus EV edges. Examples, you know, therapists, conditioning yourself to sleep 3 hours a day, or being a nice person, you know, for the sheer enjoyment of it. That's what somebody asked as a question. I think it's awesome. And then we'll get into the closing question, which is, you know, if you go back, we asked this to everyone, if you were to go back 5 years and talk to a previous version of yourself, what advice would you give your old self? So I asked them both as one, you know, share some things, and I know they'll come back and play. Plus we get to answer more people's questions off Twitter, which is always a good thing.
Okay. I would say, yeah. Well, first off, yes, therapy is hugely plus EV. I think focusing on others, huge, like, makes you feel better, makes you happy. It's get out of your own head. I mean, there's so many little things like that are, but stay in the moment. I don't know. I mean, all these are easier said than done, first off. So, and they're, you know, it's always a work in progress trying to integrate them. So if I could go back 5 years and talk to a previous version of myself, like, I think the advice I would give would be stuff that I'd already heard. I just wasn't ready for it yet, or I just hadn't had the experiences yet to put it into practice, if that makes sense. I mean, maybe like I could give advice, like, well, I'd have to go back further, but like, don't bet on Kyle Stanley or something like that. But, but I mean, the stuff would be sort of, you know, enjoy the journey, appreciate every day, stay in the moment. But what's interesting is that back in 2016, so that's 5 years ago, I went on this mindfulness retreat, sort of Chautauqua, actually, in Ecuador with a group of strangers. I read about it on this site. I'm going to plug a website here that is not mine, and I have no affiliate deal with it, but it's an awesome site. Raptitude.com. That's R-A-P-T-I-T-U-D-E, Raptitude.com. It's a blog. This guy, David Kane. At the time, the tagline for the site was a street level view of the human experience. But it's like philosophical, I don't know what the right spiritual, you know, self-improvement, whatever you want to call that stuff. It's the stuff I like. And I found out about it there. So I went down to Ecuador for this mindfulness Chautauqua thing. And there was this guy that gave a presentation. There were a few people that gave presentations, speakers. This guy, Leo Babauta, with the site Zen Habits, and J.D. Roth, Get Rich Slowly, I think is his site. And he basically, we did this exercise that was about it was, I forget what the questions exactly were. It was like, if you had only 5 years to live, what would you do? Or then if you only had 1 year, you know, and based on how much money you had, what would you, you know, would you live your life differently? And then it ended up with us getting to, creating sort of a life purpose thing. I forget, basically like, what is important to you in your life? He had a better name for it than that, obviously, but I remember coming up with these three things. I still remember what they are. They were like do things that bring myself and others joy, prioritize people and relationships, and be present for every moment of my life. And those are things that I wanted to, you know, it's the kind of thing you don't think about every day, but you should go back, you know, and make sure you're living your life according to your mission statement or whatever. And I think like I really liked that, but I don't think I've actually necessarily lived by that the last 5 years. And what's funny is I think now I'm more capable of doing that. It just sometimes things take longer, you know. I'm a slow learner. What can I say? And so I don't know. I've loved the last 5 years. Things, they've been difficult at times, but like I've had some fantastic experiences, and I'm just learning every day. I think just that I think just having a growth mindset like that is the key to being fulfilled and always growing and being happy.
I think that's some valuable advice.
I don't even know what it was that I said, but
well, just in general, I mean, like I'm on raptitude.com right now. I have no problem on unplugging it just in general, but like getting better at being human is sort of like the tagline there. And I mean, there's some articles here about how to get out of your own head, how to remember you're alive and things of that nature. And it's like that positive reinforcement, right? Where it was a lot of times we focus on the negative and sort of kind of just living in the present, you know, soaking up that moment and just kind of enjoying it type of thing. And I think a lot of people could truly learn from stuff like that.
I mean, it's the stuff that's important. When you look back at the end of your life, I mean, you're not going to wish you worked more. I mean, I think it's very different for everybody. What gives you fulfillment? Figure that out and live a life according to what you value. But you have to be open to figure that out, I guess. So, and it's so easy to just have blinders on. And I do it all the time where I'm just like, go, go, going. And then I look up and like, I'm overworked. I'm having focused stuff on a relationship. Like, you know, things are falling apart and it's like, well, how did I get here? So for me, it takes like extremes for me to like get back on track, but hopefully you guys are better at that than me.
I mean, I think we all struggle with it in general. It's just human nature. Rufus, really appreciate the time and you taking the time to join us today. That's a pro sports bettor, Rufus Peabody, the co-founder of Unabated Sports, which you can check out on Twitter at Unabated Sports, and you can visit the website unabated.com. Also the co-host of the Bet the Process podcast with Jeff Ma. Rufus, wish you the best of luck over the remainder of the golf year and into the NFL season. And hope you guys get Unabated off the ground with some early success this year.
Thanks, Rob. And thanks, Johnny, for having me. And I hope you're very successful in NFL betting this year. And I hope BetStamp is very successful as well.
Thanks, Positive Rufus. We appreciate it. And we'll see everyone next week. Thanks, guys.